Romeo India Whiskey here with K2KEY, Mel. It's time we begin the tech bed. And we're going to be taking our sign-ins and handling questions in a normal manner at first on the TechNet. And then there's going to be a discussion as to what the TechNet is and what it is not. Because there's been a fair amount of misunderstanding along those lines. So, do we have any check-ins tonight? The TechNet usually has the main subject of discussion of what you guys bring to the TechNet. In other words, we start off discussing what you guys bring in your questions. And after that, it branches into other things. But that's the main thing that it promises to be, a question and answer period live among the staff of experts that and quasi-experts that gather here and correct us when we make mistakes. So a check-in person will give me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, M2EO, Rich, and yes. Or WS2N, Paul, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at the time.
N2ATG, Dave, and yes.
N2RSO, Frank, and yes.
Okay, we've got Dave and Frank. Anyone else?
N2EO, Rich, and yes.
Rich, anyone else? Enjoy. Okay, that was a perfect double. I want, will you two guys try again?
This is WC2C, Aaron. No questions tonight, Dick.
Aaron?
KC2OJO, Howard, no.
Okay.
And all this is K2KEY.
Okay. WC2C, Howard, and Mel, in that order. Anyone else?
W2LIR, Mark, just listen.
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions at this time, Steve.
Okay, Mark and Steve recognized. Anyone else?
Yeah, Johnny, good evening, Dick, WHCDL. Depending on how much time we have, I may have want to have that discussion of what we spoke about on the phone. Time permitting, because we have a little bit of a big turnout tonight. I got a number of things to take care of, but I'll be listening in the background. Back to you.
Very fine, Andy. Okay, the first person who signed in was Dave. Haven't heard you for a while, Dave, although I got a nice email from you. And I know that you're visiting some nice sites these days, so N2APG, K2LAW. You got it, Dave.
Hey, Dick, and good evening to everybody. N2APG, Dave in Mexico. Just a quick astronomy heads up. If anybody's interested tonight, there's going to be two opportunities during the TechNet where people can see the International Space Station. If you feel it's appropriate, I'll give out the info.
I think it's definitely appropriate. And I presume you found this possibly from Heavens Above or a similar website. What hour or what direction? And how bright is it going to be, Dave?
Yeah, you're correct. The information comes from the Heavens Above website. I check it on a regular basis every week to see, gives you a heads up to see what's going to be able to be seen from your viewing location. Two opportunities tonight to see the space station. It's going to be pretty bright both times. The first time will start about 8:41 and last for about 4 minutes. And it's going to be in the northern sky, fairly low, traveling from left to right. So that's 8:41 to about 8:45. Look north, low in the sky, left to right. Second time is about 10:15. This time it's going to be in the west-northwest sky. So you'll face west-northwest. It's going to be come up about 10 degrees fairly low in the sky, and it'll come up higher. So it'll go kind of up in the sky. The first one is going to be left to right. The second one is going to be from low to about half, maybe 3 or 4 minutes. And that starts at 10:15.
Very good, Dave. So 8:41 start and 10:15 start, space station.
International Space Station, and both either north for the 841 and now west-northwest for a start on 10-15. Good information. And for those people who go to Heavens Above website, I think it's heavensabove.com or is it heavensabove.net? I'm going to guess it's .com. And you dial in your local city. They ask for it in any kind of a form. What town do you live in? What's your latitude and longitude? If you just give them New York City, it's close enough. The space station's at a good high altitude, and we're not that far from New York City, and it'll immediately give you a listing. And you can tell it what satellite you're interested in. International Space Station is one of the biggest. But you can use it to track a whole lot of other objects. Fun type space station, a fun type of website to go to. Okay, the next person who signed in was Frank, M2RSO. Frank, what would you like to discuss tonight? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Yeah, my question tonight is one of those what-if questions concerning coaxial cable. Now, I know you are a proponent of 70-ohm hard line, and my question is all of that. Again, what if? Let's take a hypothetical situation of a 40-foot length of cable vision minus 70-ohm hard line. And add on one end 20 feet of, let's say, RG-13, a 50-ohm coax. On the other end, we add an additional length, 20 feet of RG-13, and connect that to the transceiver. My question is, what does the transceiver see in terms of the medium, and how does that affect the gain or loss?
Okay, now, you're proposing to use a 70-ohm hard line of cable vision. Out of curiosity, is it the 3/4 inch, or are you thinking of using the 70-ohm drop line that, that goes from the telephone pole to your house? Give me a couple of words on that one first, Frank. Go ahead.
No, it's the 3/4 inch.
Okay, but only 40 feet of the 3/4 inch. See, transmission line has a certain amount of loss, usually rated in decibels per 100 feet. And just to take a ridiculous example, if I only needed a transmission line of 10 foot of length, it almost wouldn't matter if I used RG-58, RG-59, RG-213. RG-58 is a small diameter stuff. It's about a third of an inch. And at 432, that stuff has got about 14 dB per 100 feet. But if I'm only using 10 feet of it, I'm only going to get 1.4 dB of loss. And so it almost doesn't matter. So 40 feet is almost in that region where it's short enough that do you want to go through all the rigmarole of putting in the connectors on the hard line and adapting that to your flexible piece of RG-213? It's up to you. And there's other advantages of the hard line. The hard line can be directly buried in the ground, properly installed. It's very rugged stuff. You can slap it down the side of the tower with metal rat lap duct type devices, or even with hose clamp. I've held it to a tower leg with hose clamp, and so you can tighten those hose clamps as tight as you want within reason. You try to do that with RG-213 and you'll kink it. And so it's got a number of advantages. Now, you get the major advantage out of this extremely low loss 3/4 inch or 7/8 inch, whichever one you get a hold of, 70-ohm hard line. You get a very low loss because it's large in diameter. It's got a foam center conductor, a foam dielectric, large diameter center conductor. So its construction gives you low loss, its large diameter gives you low loss, and the fact that it's 70-ohm gives you lower loss than you would get with 50-ohm. So those are the main advantages when you got a long run, and I probably use over 1,000 feet of it on my property right now to my tower. However, it is a little bit troublesome to install the connectors on the end. The so-called finger connector, to properly install it, you have to whittle away a certain amount of the foam that's in there to make room for the finger connector. There are a few ways that guys have come up with homebrew plumbing fittings and make a forcer connector, a UHF connector among other kinds. They force it into the hardline, 70-ohm, 3/4 inch hardline. And by the way, when you go to your docking station or whatever you call it, the the place where they store the materials for the cable company, and you ask for spare pieces they've got left over, and they've always got spare pieces left over. Let me drop. They buy it in 5,000 foot reels, and when there's 200 feet left on the end of the reel, they're afraid to start another run down the block because they'd have to use a splice, and the splice they consider unreliable. So they usually have a bunch of wooden reels laying around with 150 and 250 feet of the stuff on it. And if you ask them for it, they'll give it to you for a song or for a, just for a nuisance fee of some kind. And the wooden reel, you don't even have to take that. You can take the wooden reel apart. You don't even have to unreel the hard line. You just take the four bolts on the wooden reel apart, and it's two pipe plates on each side and a bunch of wooden flaps in the middle. You take out the wooden flap, and in your hand is a nice, neatly rolled chunk of a three-quarter inch hard line. So getting the stuff is easy. And by the way, they call it 750. That means it's 0.750 inches in diameter. They call it 750 cable. You call it three-quarter inch hard line, they say, what's that? They got to use their vocabulary. And then the connectors that go on the end of it, they call it the singer connector, because it's made to plug into the side of a box, which usually contains an amplifier. And it's got a long center pin that you cut to the right length, and the thread is the same as the back nut on your tight end connector, your UG21 nail connector. And so with a little bit of adapting, you can put that connector on the end of the singer, and now you've got a nail connector on the end of a piece of hard line. But there's a little bit of rigmarole there, of whittling out the foam. If you want to do the exotic approach, you buy the special coring tool, which I own. But that tool's a little bit pricey. Although maybe a club like this one, a large enough club, should own a copy of that tool and loan it out to various people. But if not, you can do 90% as good of a job with whittling out the foam with your X-Acto knife or your Swiss Army knife. And the connector itself does a beautiful job of mechanically grabbing onto the end of the cable, giving you a good weather feel. So for a long run, that hard line is a great way to go. Lots and lots of amateurs have told each other year after year. So for years, the hams have told each other that each connector has got a half a dB of loss, and that's pure hogwash, and therefore they go through heroic efforts to make sure they don't put connectors anywhere, because they want one straight piece of flexible cable coming out of the back of the rig, going through the hole in the wall, going up the tower, and connecting to the antenna, and no other connectors in between, because they think each connector's got a half a dB of loss. Absolutely, positively not. But you can tune across the 20-meter band, and guys will be telling each other that time after time, and because they've all heard it so often, they think it's the truth. It is not. And UHF connectors, people think, has got more loss than type N connectors. I have taken a pair of UHF connectors, back-to-back, male-to-male, female-to-female. I put 700 watts through them for 10 solid minutes, going up the feed line to my 432 Yagi, fed it with a parallel kilowatt amplifier. 700 watts for 10 minutes. Turned off the transmitter, walked over and touched the connector. It was mildly warm to the touch, which means it was dissipating a fraction of a watt out of 700. That's numbers like 0.03 dB of exertion loss. Connectors don't have loss, unless you've got an ohmic contact that's not properly forming. So if your ohm meter can confirm that you're making good contact on your connector, there is no mechanism for loss there. The only thing that gives you loss is something that's got real resistance to it, or really flaky contact, or something that's got a whole lot of length. Yeah, you do get loss out of 100 feet of transmission line because of its pure length, when you're lighting up a whole lot of dielectric materials and a whole lot of copper and a whole lot of aluminum. So you only get loss out of length and resistance, and a connector doesn't have either one of those if you're taking a good connector and using it correctly. So don't worry about connector loss. Now, Frank's basic question was, what happens when I put 50 ohm antenna or 50 ohm cable on one end or both ends of a 70 ohm line? If you did it just once on one end, by definition, 70 ohms and 50 ohms is something like a 1.4 standing wave ratio. I'm getting out my calculator here, and I'll eventually give you a more exact answer. But you divide 70 ohms by 50, the ratio of the resistance is the ratio of the standing wave ratio. And let's see now. Press enter. 50. Enter. Divide. It's a 1.4. Good. So if I put a 70 ohm something, cable, antenna, whatever, on the end of a 50 ohm cable, or vice versa, Because of the ohmic difference, I have created a 1.4 standing wave ratio. The first question is, what is the impact of a 1.4 standing wave ratio? All I know is that a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which all of us lose a lot of sleep over, if we had that condition, we'd think we're in really bad shape, has less than half a decibel of loss in the worst case if you don't re-impedance match. In other words, if I had a if I had a 50 ohm transmitter and I connect a 70 ohm cable to it, right at the interface, I've got a 1.4 standing wave ratio, which is a potential loss of probably something like 0.3 dB. So we can work out the mathematics of that. If I readjust the tuning and loading controls on the transmitter so that there's a proper impedance match to a 70 ohm cable, there would be no loss at all. But worst case, if I do nothing, I've got something like a couple of tenths of a dB loss whenever there is an interface of 70 ohm cable and 50 ohm cable. And now, in your case, you're doing it twice. And there is 40 feet of cable in between, which has got a little bit of loss, therefore there's some buffering going on. The reason I say that is because if you were lucky that the piece of hard line in between the two connectors was an exact multiple of a half wavelength long. What's nice about multiples of half wavelength of cable is no matter what impedance you put on the far end, that's the exact impedance you see on the near end. Let me give you an exact example. Assume I've got three half wavelengths. That's a multiple of a half wavelength. I've got three half wavelengths of 70 ohm cable. And I put a 10 ohm resistor on the far end, a good RF 10 ohm resistor. And I put a network analyzer on the near end and make a measurement. What will I see? The answer is 10 ohms. Half wavelengths of cable and multiples of a half wavelength cable are an impedance repeater if there is very low loss in the cable. Life gets a little bit better than that if the cable's got some loss. But so the fact that you're putting 50 ohm cable on one end and 50 ohm cable on the other end, if your 70 ohm cable happens to be an exact half wavelength multiple, then there is no impedance mismatch, believe it or not. The worst case situation is it's an odd number of quarter wavelengths. One quarter wave, three quarter wave, five quarter waves. Now it's an impedance inverter. 70 ohm cable, 50 ohm load on one end. The input end would be 100 ohm. It's a kind of an inversion that goes on. If you want a little more understanding of this, Mel's got a beautiful section on the Smith chart that tells you how to do it. This is very close to one of the problems that Mel solved. When you go to amateurradio.tv and you go to the advanced users section, you'll find out there's a section where Mel has all canned, Mike Perry has all canned Mel's reports on how to use a Smith chart, and you can plot the exact situation if you've got some other length of cable in between. The Smith chart and the mathematical equivalent will tell you exactly what's going on. The bottom line of all this, Frank, is that it's good for your concern. When you zoom back enough and look at the big picture, I wouldn't be concerned at all. I would go do it. I think the worst that's going to happen is you're going to have a couple of tenths of dB of extra loss because of the impedance mismatch. But you can then go further, and there's two or three things you can do. You can set that 40-foot of cable. You can make that 40 feet of cable some exact number of half wavelengths long, in which there is no impedance mismatch. Or you can put a... if you really want to take the elaborate approach, you can build a quarter wave matching section of probably 66 ohm or 60 ohm cable. You can put a quarter wavelength of 60 ohm cable between the 50 and the 70, and now they're perfectly matched. And you can do that at both ends. Much more elaborate than you've got to do. But you've got multiple solutions. You've got a nice low loss cable. I would just go do it and stop worrying. In my case, I've got lots and lots of pieces of 70 ohm cable, about 1,000 feet of it, and various runs going up my tower. I've got all 50 ohm antennas. I've got all 50 ohm instrumentation and transmitters and receivers in the shack. I've made the joke a few times that what I've done is to put a piece of tape alongside of the 70 ohm cable, right on the 70 ohm cable. And I wrote the word 50 ohms on that piece of paper tape. And I made sure that that side of the paper tape faces toward the transmitter or toward the antenna, and therefore the transmitter didn't know to be unhappy and the antenna didn't know to be unhappy. Of course, that's a joke, but what I'm getting at is the impedance mismatch between 70 and 50 is so mild by comparison to the usual visor we have with our antennas on the extremes of our band. You put up an 80-meter dipole, and you tune it for the 3.6 megacycle section because you like Morse code on that particular section. And that half-wave full dipole, nice and high in the air, that you tune the 3.6 megacycles and you use it at 4.0, it probably has a 2.4-to-1 standing wave ratio up there at 4.0 when you talk to the sideband guys up there. The antenna obviously works. So the 1.4 this one we're talking about here is pretty small change, and not to worry. Go do it. It ain't going to explode. It ain't going to get hot. Nothing bad's going to happen. And when the day comes when you want that last couple of tenths of dB of performance out of your system, there's a couple of very simple things you can go and do to make that improvement if you want to do it. And let us know how well it works out, Frank. M2RSO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Thank you very much. Yeah, basically what I had planned to do is connect a 7-element Yagi with a 7-element Yagi, very heavy-duty one. And it sort of occurred to me that rather than connect the coax and have to move to the TV, especially if I can get it up high enough, to put this hard line, send the hard line in the antenna. This way I can coax attached to a rotator, the hard line, that's quite well enough to use a rotator. And then on the other end, it also could be on coax to bring it to the shack and to the transceiver. So I'm just curious to know whether there is any problem with this thing, but I can see there won't be. So I guess we'll give it a try. So thank you again.
Very fine, Frank. You could use a little bit more rodeo, a little bit low in audio, but not very much. And what you're doing is almost exactly what I'm doing, Frank. All of my 70-ohm hard lines go to the top of the tower, and I don't connect them to RG213. I connect them to RG214, my favorite cable, because it's got a double shield and it's a little bit more strength, a mechanical strength, and maybe a little bit better weatherproofing, I'm not sure, and no real increase in insertion loss. And that's what goes around the rotator in my particular case. Okay, let's see. We've got Dave, Frank. Rich is the next guy to sign it. N2EO, what would you like to talk about tonight? And what's going on there in Whitestone, Rich, K2RIW?
Good evening, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, Limon, N2EO. Wanted to talk on the subject of radio restoration that I've been into now. Been restoring this Collins KWM2 since the beginning of March. We're going into the 6 months. And the radio's starting to look like I wanted it to, basically almost like a new radio. Done a lot of work on it. It's up and running, been getting on the air with it. What I've been doing, Dick, in the past on some antique gear, I've done my own electroplating. Antique Electronic Supply in Tempe, Arizona sells an electroplating material brushes. The conductive brushes, you tie the work to the negative side of the battery, positive side goes to the conductive brush, and you brush a gel-like substance on, and they've got the nickel, copper, they've got nickel, brass, silver, and forget what else. Anyway, what I'm getting at, I recently cleaned up the chassis. I used a pine oil solvent, actually made for cleaning. My housekeeper uses it. I went down the chassis. I went over it with a paintbrush, and this pine oil cleaner got all the oxidation off. It was only surface oxidation. And then I scrubbed it with a toothbrush, the chassis, and then went over it with more pine oil and warm water, let it sit for 24 hours before I dare turn it on. Everything worked out. The chassis nice and clean and bright and shiny. Everything good up to there. What I then went to do was to re-electroplate some of the hardware, in particular the saddles on the 7 and 9 pin tube sockets. They had some pitting. I wanted to get them bright and shiny again. And what happened is, I don't think there's steel. Maybe you can't electroplate that tin. I don't know. Or maybe you have to use, like, on steel, when you silver plate, you first have to put an undercoat of brass plating and then silver plate over the brass. I don't know what happened is the tube sockets came out looking like a gray color. I only did one as a test, and the chassis around the sockets from the electroplating got like a gray color. I think the chassis is magnesium. It could be aluminum, but I believe it's magnesium. I think that's what Collins used. It's like a brushed aluminum or magnesium. The electroplating left like a gray color on the chassis around the socket that I tried to electroplate. I'd like to know what I could do to polish out that gray-like shadow it left. I tried using a buffing wheel on a Dremel tool. That didn't work. Didn't do anything. I'm wondering if I could use Scotch-Brite, or I don't want to make it worse. And then I would like to go ahead and see what I could do to replace that hardware in there. Back to net, into we go.
Pretty fine, Rich. Lots of audio. Good sounding audio you got there. For the people who do restoring of equipment, boy, some of them get a lot of pleasure out of doing it. Particularly Collins equipment, which is considered a Cadillac of ham radio equipment in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. For people who own or like to own a whole lot of pieces of Collins equipment, I can't think of how you call it now. One of the members of Limock owns probably 50 or more pieces of Collins equipment. Who am I thinking of here, Rich?
Maybe Al, K6DPC. He's got quite a bit of Collins stuff.
That's the man, Al. That's the man. I haven't talked to Hal very often. I'm also very forgetful on people's names, as you can tell. So there are people who develop a lot of pleasure out of maintaining, restoring, obtaining, and using the older Collins equipment, among other brands. The poor man's Collins equipment is Drake. There are people who like restoring Drake. There are people who have a very warm feeling about Heathkit equipment, and they like restoring and bringing up to date older pieces of Heathkit equipment because it represents the youth and they get a warm, fuzzy feeling. Remember the days of building the kit, turning it on the first time, troubleshooting it, using it on the air. That gave them a lot of pleasure. So restoring equipment, that's one whole section of ham radio that is almost as important to some people as cutting the state-of-the-art of a zillion megacycle antenna and talking a zillion miles with it, so to speak. They get the same amount of pleasure. And so when we talk about the 26 different kinds of ham radio, I'm usually talking about RF techniques, you know, meteor scatter, moon bounce, ionospheric reflection, tropo, and so on. But another kind of ham radio is restoring equipment. Now, when it comes to electroplating, that is an art and a science, without a doubt, that's got all kinds of complications to it. First of all, when you think the chassis was magnesium, I'm extremely skeptical of that. I only know of a couple of pieces of equipment that are on planet Earth that have been used with a magnesium chassis. One of them was a state-of-the-art, flat-out design that was done for a man-packed radar called the BTS-5, TIP-5 radar, that was designed for Vietnam service. It was a KU-band radar, 16.25 gigahertz radar, where you would transport this thing into the woods on the back of a man, set up this little tripod, and it would look three clicks into the woods and tell you, is anything out there moving? So there'll be a truck, a man could be crawling across the ground. 3 clicks away, 3 kilometers away through the woods. That radar would find him, give you a characteristic sound in the earphones, and you'd know what's coming your way. It gives you forewarning of 3 kilometers. Beautiful piece of equipment. But that had a magnesium tripod, a magnesium chassis, because it had to be strong, ultralight, and money was no object. But the magnesium itself is an exotic material. You expose magnesium to air because the paint gets chipped and it corrodes almost immediately. So they had to be very careful with the kind of paint they put on it to make sure that it doesn't get exposed to air. And when you've got to screw down a connector and make good electrical contact with magnesium and yet continuously protect it from air exposure and exposure of anything else, it's a very difficult material to use. Expensive. So because they didn't need a chassis that's ultra-light and yet strong enough, and because they weren't willing to pay the extra price and have the extra vulnerability of magnesium, I'm very skeptical that magnesium was used. And electroplating magnesium, I'll guarantee it's difficult. Now, when it comes to what dissimilar metals you're allowed to bring in contact with each other during the electroplating process, there's a lot of literature on that subject. It's a lot more complicated than you think. For instance, there's many a tight case where you've got copper contacts on, say, for instance, a printed circuit board. And you've got copper microstrip, strip line, whatever, and you want an edge connector at one end. And you know that the copper is going to build up copper oxide, therefore it's going to make a flaky contact into the edge connector, and therefore you're going to gold plate it. And the gold plating is a noble metal that doesn't corrode in time. And if you've got perfect gold plating on the edge connectors of your printed circuit board, and gold plated contacts on the connector itself, that can be an extremely reliable situation. And therefore you'd say, gee, I'm going to gold plate the gold on top of the copper. You cannot do that. There's something about the gold that doesn't want to simply stay on top of the copper. No matter how much gold you put there, and I've seen people put gold in extremely thick layers of it, and a few hours later, the gold is gone, and it looks yucky. And you say, what the hell happened? Well, the gold, for some reason, gold and copper, one will migrate into the other. The gold will literally dig itself into the copper and disappear from the surface. And you ain't got no gold on top of the surface. And what's left is a pretty yucky-looking copper with little patches of gold in certain places. The gold won't stay there. So there's got to be a nickel flashing, or there's got to be some other material in between the copper and the gold, which is inert between that material and the copper, and inert between that material and the gold. So electroplating, what material you can electroplate on top of what other material, that's something you got to go kind of slow with. The word steel and the word stainless steel is not one material. This is 304 stainless, an 18 and 8 stainless. There's probably 5 different alloys of stainless steel, some of which you can solder to if you use Tinner's fluid. Some of them you can't solder to them. Some of them are magnetic. Some of them are not. So even the word stainless steel is not one material. And when it comes to steel, boy, there's all kinds of steel, depending on the grain size, how it was made, what alloys are mixed with it, and so on. So, and the people who do electroplating have a whole lot of individual cleaning baths they go through. The pine oil cleaning fluid you use probably does a good job of removing oxide and doing a cleaning job of previous dirt that was deposited on that chassis. But does it leave a residue? Almost all soapy cleaning solutions. Almost all cleaning solutions leave some kind of a soapy residue of their own, which then alcohol or some other kind of solvent has to be used to remove that residue. You talk to a person who used to work at an electroplating plant, and you find out there's all kinds of acid baths and whatever that the material to be electroplated gets dumped into, cleaned and dunked and etched and whatever, before you do the real electroplating process. So you've got to control the materials, you got to control the surface, you've got to have extremely clean surfaces, and so on. So just having an electrified brush, a conductive brush with the right material on it to do electroplating, it might work some of the time, but I think you got to go a little bit slower with that one, do a little more study, Rich. On top of that, way you've got one material and you want to put another material on top, and one of those materials is vivid. When you studied what happens with electroplating, you're really setting up an electrostatic field, and curved surfaces behave in very peculiar ways, particularly concave surfaces, and pitting is microscopically a concave surface. And to try to get the right volts per meter across the microscopic sections of that pitted material, and to have the electroplating material go into that pit, go into a concave surface, and there's a whole science in itself. How do you electroplate something that has an inner surface or is concave? You have to put electroplating wires and whatever inside to control the local E field in order to create the electroplating. Electroplating into a corner, if you've got a right angle corner section of a piece of chassis, for instance, and you want the electroplating to go down into the sharp edge of that corner, very difficult to do. So these are some of the problems you're running into, Rich. I ain't got an answer for you. I'm just telling you some of the degree of difficulty, and some of the words maybe will help you do some further research on how to solve it in this particular case. Now, hopefully within the sound of my voice right now, somebody knows a little bit more about electroplating, particularly of the kind that Rich is doing, and can give us a couple of hints. If so, please give us your call letters right now. We want to hear from you. K2LIW in the back there.
Sorry,
Rich? Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, not the chassis I'm trying to electroplate. Maybe I didn't make myself clear. I'm trying to replace the plating that was on the saddles of the tube sockets. The metal saddles on the tube sockets, I believe they're either tin. I don't believe they're aluminum. I used a nickel plate, and what happened, right, it didn't plate the sockets properly, but it left on the chassis where I was wiping back and forth, you know, the socket is up against the chassis. It left like a gray color around one of the tube sockets, and I'm wondering what I could use to polish that back out. I tried using a buffing wheel on a Dremel tool. That had no effect. I don't know if it's magnesium. I can tell you it's a bright brushed metal. It's very, very light, which is characteristic of magnesium. And I know they have the front, what looks like heliarc welded to the chassis. The back apron on the front panel looks like it's heliarc to the chassis, the horizontal chassis. And I had occasion to mount a couple of jacks on there because I'm using I added a digital outboard digital frequency counter, so I had to get to the HFO, the PFO, and VFO, and I mounted a little bulkhead RCA connector. And when I drilled that, it did not drill like aluminum. It was very hard.
Okay, you are talking about the saddles of the tube sockets. I presume saddle means the metallic rim around the phenolic of the tube socket, the part that's got the screws that mount it to the chassis. Is that what the saddle is, Rich? Go ahead.
You got it, Dick. They're somewhat pitted. Some of them are pitted and discolored, and I wanted to bring up the brightness. Now, I've done electroplating in the past on some 1930 Hallicrafters equipment. In that case, I re-put toggle switches. There I used brass and then silver over the brass. And that worked out fine, but throwing just the nickel over that, whatever metal that is, that did not work out.
You know what he's done.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, what they used on those saddles, I know he's going through there. There is a way, but it's what they were originally, Vic, what they called cadmium plated over.
Okay, and I'll bet you re-establishing cadmium plating, I'll bet you that's no easy process. What do you think, Mel?
Sand plastic.
Okay, what do you do after you've moved it out as best as possible? A couple of guys told me how they do it. They used in the photographic developing process, that silver nitrate that comes off, that washes off, I believe it's called silver nitrate, They use that to play this deck number. The restorer told me that, over.
Sand blasted. Sand blasting is one very nice way to get a nice patina to a surface and remove all of the dirt and pitting and whatever. They call it sand blasting, but nowadays it really is little spherical beads of some kind of a sand-like material in a machine where you've got these great big rubber gloves, and it's a box that stains the material, and it comes out of a ceramic nozzle and does a very good job. Now, with hindsight, Rich, what I think you should have done, this is just a guess on my part, maybe somebody's going to correct me, is to recognize the fact that the cadmium plating or the chrome plating or whatever it was of the saddles, of the tube sockets, are a different material from the chassis. Therefore, during the time that you're doing whatever operation on that tube socket, I think the socket should have been disconnected from that chassis. Loosen the screws that mount it down. I know there's wires on the back end and you can't move it very far, but if you lifted the socket above the chassis and put a bunch of paper tape or some other kind of protective material on the chassis itself, so that now you're only operating electroplating-wise or cleaning-wise or whatever you're doing on the saddle of the tube socket independent of the chassis, and you disconnect it from the chassis and separated it with some kind of material. You know, put a piece of fish paper in there, a small, very thin diameter phenolic board or whatever, around the tube socket, separating it from the chassis, then do the operation on the socket. Now you would not be doing an attempted operation like the electroplating on the chassis, because the chassis is one material, the saddle of the tube socket is another material, and to electroplate both simultaneously has more than twice the risk of something coming out wrong, and that's part of what you've seen. Now, the buffing wheel that you've used on your Dremel tool maybe is not aggressive enough. They also make a brass brush circular device that you can put on your Dremel tool that's more aggressive, and they make even a steel version of that, which is more aggressive yet. A combination of that, sand blasting, and whatever, you can get back down to the base material, if that's what you want to do. Although, if there already is a plating on the tube socket, or there already is a plating on the chassis, and now you remove that plating and get down to the base material, only in one section, and now you want to restore it, but you want it to all look nice and smooth across that section onto the undisturbed section, that's a little bit of a problem, chassis-wise. Tube socket-wise, it may be a little bit easier, but to go a little bit slower and identify what materials are on that saddle and whether or not what you're about to put on is compatible and should it be separated from the chassis when you do it. These are a few of my suggestions, Rich, if I was in that kind of a restoration operation. N2EO to take it with a delay in case we get other people with suggestions for you. KQLIW in the TechMan.
Okay, Dick, very good. So, yeah, that'll occur to me. I happened, what I'll do maybe, like you say, is loosen the machine screws that hold the socket down, pull up on the socket a fraction of an inch, and put a piece of paper, like a paper washer, if you will, that I can fashion onto there. But, yeah, the chassis is a bright silver. It's got brush marks in it, you know, like brushed metal. Any idea what that might be and how I can get that? If not, get the brushing back. Get the thing to shine again.
Yeah, I don't know any Collins equipment. I wish Hal was here. Mel, you got any suggestions on that one?
KEY, I was fortunate enough that all my Collins equipment, chassis, everything was just A1 condition, just needed just general blowing out dust, you know, just really minor cleaning up. What you could do with those saddles, if you really want to change them, Rich, no big deal. You notice it just crimps over. And you can find a lot of sockets like that. I always see them around the handset, chunk files and all. And just flip off the rings. You just have to bend the two tabs on the bottom. And, you know, the ring just flips on and holds against the plastic material. So you want to be a little bit on the adventurous side. Pull the socket back up a little bit, like Dick said. You can most likely, possibly, gently bend up the two tabs and flip the saddle off and flip another one on. That's one way of doing it. The other way, they restored a number of these, put that plating or whatever kind of covering over the cadmium, original cadmium, As I said, they use that silver nitrate, that new photographic processing, that silver nitrate that comes off into the developer. And it seems like that stuff was the choice of many of the restorers think over.
Very good. Let me ask you this question now. What's your best guess as to the chassis itself on a piece of McCollum's equipment? Is it copper-plated steel, or when you look on the edges of the chassis, inside and outside, what's your best guess as to what is the real material of the chassis of a typical piece of Collins equipment? You got it, Mel.
Now, if you look at the edge of it, it's basically almost the same color through and through. I would assume it was most likely steel. Not aluminum, definitely not. They never had aluminum chassis, to my knowledge. No. Collins never had an aluminum chassis. They only had steel chassis, punched steel chassis. I would say that this is the same steel type of that was used during World War II on all those chassis surplus equipment things, because this is all outgrowths of, Collins, of course, during World War II, made many of the pieces of communications equipment. And those chassis, whatever you find in surplus equipment, most likely is the same thing they carried over. I'm sure they didn't change processing of punching and all that after the war, and when they started more or less using got away from war production. So I think that that steel was the same common steel that was used right through from the back from the 40s, Dick, and then you'll find in all the surplus equipment over.
Okay, you've convinced me that it is a punched chunk of steel for the holes for mounting things and the holes for the sockets and so on. After the punching, I'm guessing then it was put into a brake machine that bent the corners, and then some of the corners probably had overlapping that was spot welded. And steel, if it's ordinary steel, stainless steel, by the way, does not remain stainless after you punch it. So I'm sure it's not stainless steel. And almost all of the stainless, all of the normal steels will rust. So you're punching the holes, you're bending the corners, you're overlapping corners, you're spot welding the corners, I'm guessing. And then you've got to do something to protect that steel. What's your guess as to the coating they put on top of the punched, bent, spot welded steel? Over to you, Mel.
It's stuff definitely that they can solder to, because they've got a lot of ground connections that were soldered to the chassis. So I would say that I believe that's what they call that cadmium plating, Dick. What the process exactly is in cadmium plating, but I know that was a method of rust proofing all the chassis way back over.
And cadmium plating scares me. The bolts, for instance, of a 28-foot T.S. Kennedy dish, and I've owned a couple of those, in the early days were cad plated. That's the good news. They gave you partial weather protection. But eventually the cadmium plating disappears. Cadmium is a heavy metal that is toxic. So handling cadmium plated materials nowadays is considered a risky process. So was it really cadmium plated? And in which case, my understanding is the cadmium, particularly outdoors, only lasts for a finite length of time. Indoors, I'm sure it's going to last longer, but not forever. And restoring the cadmium plating and making it look the same after you've done some local electroplating strikes me as a very difficult thing to do. And even if you did use an aggressive brush to remove all of the material that got electroplated on top in the vicinity of the two socket saddles, now you're removing your new material, you're digging into some of the cadmium plating, and that's what it was of the old material, and you're left now with raw steel that's going to be grayish looking and eventually possibly acquire some rust. So are you sure it was cad plating? In which case, it is considered nowadays, I believe, a heavy metal toxic material. Over to you for any comments on that one, Mel.
Tin plate.
Let's hope it was tin plate, but what do you think, Mel?
I got the book out. I'm trying to find the chassis material. Let's see if they give a A definitive of what kind of chassis material they used here. I got the, this is the, this was a classified piece of information, detail of construction of electronics equipment by the Collins Radio Company, circa 1944. Yep, 44. You have that, let's see. What do they tell you here? If, I'm looking. All right, go ahead. I'll see if I can find what they, if they make a mention of the material they're over.
Yeah, tin plating of steel is done for so-called tin cans. And I think in some cases some soldering took place on the seams, particularly on a carnation milk can. You know, people who worried about the solder being a lead-bearing material and some of the lead is reaching into the condensed milk, and is that safe? And is parts per million something that's worth worrying about? There was a lot of concern about that at one time. And so did they tin plate the chassis? As Mel digs into his classified Collins book from 1944, the war years, we'll find out. So looks like Collins did supply a lot of equipment for, I know they did for the Vietnam War, probably the Korean War, and it looks like World War II. So Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where I think their Collins was located, looks like they were busy people making all this equipment. So I think you're going to have to dig a little bit further into dissimilar metals, electroplating process, and whatever, if you're not willing to do what Mel recommended, that is just to slip off the old saddle and slip on a new one. It may be a hell of a lot easier than what you're going through. You think you have an access place for those same kind of tube sockets with a similar kind of saddle that can, you can replace, Rich. N2EO, K2LAW. Give a little bit of delay in case someone wants to help you on this one. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, check that line lock into Leo. That might be the best thing. Believe it or not, getting tube sockets is not difficult. In fact, it's probably harder to get parts for the Japanese radios that are out of production 4 or 5 years than to get parts for some of the vintage tube stuff. It's all available. You'd be surprised. All this stuff is available. You may have to search a little, but it's available. That occurred to me, but you know those battles with Krypton underneath. I don't know how easy or hard that's going to be to get off and to change. It would be nice to change the tube sockets, but that's a monumental task with all the hand wiring. All right, maybe Mel will come up with something and break back on in. Back to your Dick, K2RIW and 2EO.
And 2NNU.
And 2RSO, go ahead.
Yeah, hello, Dick. I have my computer out here, and I Googled chassis plating, and I found an interesting webpage. I don't know if Rich is familiar with it. www.andradios.com. One word, and they show a picture of an antique radio and has a label on it. It's a huge robot or something. I didn't even know they made it. But anyway, there's a comment here about cadmium. If you have cadmium and not just used dust, yes, you should be careful. Otherwise, the cap will mop down with an alcohol saturated rag to start the cleaning process. Most of the chassis is galvanized. That zinc, not cadmium plated. Cadmium is distinctly yellow, like the parts under the hood of your car. It's gray, galvanized chassis, never shown like a new diamond. I can't understand why one wants to make it pretty red if it's new. Rust spots are best removed individually, etc. Now, you come through with what? Now, if you really do run into a cadmium chassis like mine, use some common sense. Not want to run that stuff to your lungs. With a suitable HEPA filter, a GPA respirator on, stand upwards of the chassis and blood leak something like grape and then wash away that stuff. Wet clean it with alcohol, rub it well, and pretty much they're telling you to be very careful with it. it is really nice. Back to that in 2 hours, so.
Very good information, Frank. Thank goodness you brought that to our attention. And if you ever get a chance to go to a tune-up clinic, like with Andy, the Bay2CDL, have him reset the volume of your audio. You're about one-half the volume you should be. And where Rich has possibly been running an abrasive cleaning wheel of some kind on a Dremel tool, let's hope that chassis is not cadmium plated. Because if he's chipping away that cadmium plating, if that's what it is, the yellowish-looking chassis, the cadmium plating, he's chipping it away with that abrasive wheel and then breathing the dust that's coming from that. That's definitely not a good thing to do. There was another person who signed in. What were your call letters and name, sir? Please give them to me right now, KQLIW. My name is Dick.
Hello, Dick.
You forgot
me. This is N2NNU, November 2, November, November uniform. The name is Alex. Late chicken.
Very fine, Alex. And Alex, do you have something to contribute on this particular subject right now, or do you want to be on the list for somebody with a question? Back to you, Alex.
No, electroplating is a black art to me, so I will not be able to contribute, but I have a question about remoting my antenna tuner. So put me on the list with a question.
Alex is on the list with a question. So, let me give a little bit of delay and see if Mel has found something in his excavation of his particular book. Mel, if you want to, it's your choice.
Well, this is KQY. Now, they tell you so much about this construction and layout and all, and I don't see what is the finish on this thing. The only thing that they have is a reference. Now, what the heck is reference? I mean, I'm trying to find Amphenol reference 83 finish. What the heck does Amphenol have to do with this World War II in finishes? I don't know. That's what I have here. What the heck is that? Anybody know ever give an 83 finish?
Since Amphenol was a major manufacturer, and maybe still is, of connectors, and those connectors all need some kind of plating to protect them, I can see how Amphenol would have a industry standard of some kind for a plating process. That strikes me as a definite thing that could have taken place. Okay, I'm not sure we've very much answered your questions. We told you some of the dangers involved, Rich. Rich, when you look at the chassis in places where you haven't disturbed it, does it have a grayish color like zinc galvanizing? And you know what galvanizing looks like after it's been weathered for a while. It's a very dark gray. Does it look like the tin of a tin can? Or does it have a yellowish patina that maybe represents cadmium plating? Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, I only disturbed it in one tiny little spot. I'm just very critical. The whole chassis is a bright silver color.
Then I'm going to guess it was tin plating, somewhat like a tin can. Lots of tin cans were being manufactured to contain food in those days, and so I'm going to guess that chassis was steel with tin plating, and I'm going to guess the tin plating was done after the punching and the bending and welding and so on, because the raw edges where they did stamping of steel are definitely going to give you a rusting problem downrange. And even stainless steel, when you punch it, is no longer stainless in those areas where it got punched. You've got to redo the process, so to speak, of the passivating of the stainless steel. And that would be an expensive process. So I don't think they made it out of stainless, although it's possible. I'm going to get tin plating from what I'm hearing. An acceptable process. You can solder to it. It gives you protection and medium good look to the chassis some number of years downrange. Where the rusting steel chassis would look awfully ugly, and you start getting flaky contacts underneath the rust in a period of time. Okay, we're going to move on, and maybe Mel, when he finds further information, will check back in. Alex, what's going on in Yonkers, where you live, and what would you like to remotely do? Don't you wish you had a robot up there that could operate the switch for you? N2NNU, K2LAW, the tech man.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. I haven't been on this net for a long time, but you know how life is. Like pushing a wall and the silly thing doesn't want to move. Anyhow, I have this contraption that I call an antenna, which is an asymmetrical dipole, a vertical asymmetrical dipole hanging in my ginkgo tree that's about 30 meter high. So the active element is tuned, which is the top one, is tuned around the 20 meter band, about 14 to 60. And it's constructed of a piece of irrigation pipe, 5 inches diameter aluminum. This is the active portion of it. And then out of it, it is a piece of wire hangs down to the ground about 15 meters long. The feeding point is right at the connection between those two, and it runs horizontally about 10 meters to my house where it goes vertically. It tunes nicely on certain portions of the band, but on some bands I need to use an antenna tuner. However, this contraption is very close to my shack, and I have a lot of current into my feeder. It is tuning nicely on the radio, but the feeder is radiating. So I thought to move the tuner to the feeding point, so the radiating piece of cable will be as short as possible. So I have this old Versa tuner from mighty fine junk that I'm looking at it to see how I can remote it. Well, the electronic part is not a problem for me. I have the problem in finding the mechanical stuff that may build turn those capacitors and the coil. I need some sort of gearing or whatnot to be able to turn those heavy components. I'm not sure where to find those things. Perhaps you can help here, give me an indication where I can find something that will be not out of my pocket for getting some motors to make those mechanical things turn by themselves. Back to you.
Hey, I think I understand your question, Alex, and I'm going to give you a warning. You're going to get an answer to your question, but I'm not going to answer the question you asked. I'm going to answer an entirely different question you didn't ask. Everything you described to me on your 5-inch diameter pipe, the horizontal run and the vertical run of the wire and whatever, and you did describe it as an asymmetric dipole. And therefore, whenever an antenna is asymmetric, with rare exception by definition, there will be a tendency for current to flow down the transmission line of an asymmetric system. Only a thoroughly symmetric system, fed with symmetric transmission lines,